Thank you, brother. Thank you for being here.
Oh, man, thanks for having me.
Dude, come on, man. I really want to bring folks on that I just feel have really walked the walk, don't just talk about it, and are humble and kind and honest and courageous. And you're sort of, I can't really think of somebody better than you. You grew up in Bakersfield. You went into the military. I want to talk to you about Bakersfield. Went to the military, Special Forces, Delta and Ranger. You got wounded overseas. You know, you were both the subject and the star of an incredible documentary made by a very dear friend of both of ours. You know, the person that like kind of attaches you and I and Rick Waugh.
Yeah.
There are like no words for how much that guy means to me and like the chance he took on me and how he's made me kind of believe in myself. And one thing I can tell you about Rick is like anybody in Rick's orbit is just solid as fuck.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's very
just
true.
Like who's Rick Waugh and like who does Rick, like what does he mean to you?
For lack of a better term, he's just great at everything he does. And I actually, the first thing I'm going to actually say is not related to the industry or work, but he is the best father I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
How so?
You know, he strikes the perfect balance. He's got two twin boys, but he strikes the perfect balance between, in of course, my humble opinion, between treating them as kids and adults. You know, like he gives them the kid experience and leeway, yet at the same time, he doesn't bullshit him. He doesn't lie to him. You know what I mean?
Yep.
He very much treats them as mini adults, but also kids. And there's a good balance between that. And again, if there's any testament to how good of a father he is, you know, meet the kids.
Right.
You know, they're amazing.
They are.
You obviously have. And then, of course, like everything else he does, you know, as a filmmaker, as a writer, as a director, as, you know, everything he does, he's just a machine. There's nothing on a film set that he doesn't know.
Rick is such a soldier of authenticity. You
yes.
know, like he made a movie, Felon,
yep.
was sort of the first
yep.
Was the first movie he made about, you know, Corcoran prison riots and the Gladiator games. And he like literally went and like basically became a parole officer and basically
2 years.
Became a probate. Yeah. And like did that time. And you know, when, you know, he did Snitch, he did Shot Caller. Those are the movies that I did with him, that we did with him. But, you know, he gains access into a world. He craves authenticity. He provides the infrastructure and opens the door into the real world in a way that no one else that I've ever worked with, you know, does. And, you know, that's kind of where you came in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he kind of came to you. I mean, when did he first come to you?
We met through a mutual friend and he was writing a movie, a military movie. We had lunch at the Grove and that was like 2009, something mm-hmm. like that. And just right away, you know, we started talking and we worked on that script for a couple months and then started work on another one. Neither got made, but after working on that script and just talking about what I knew or from my experience, he invited me to lunch one day, which A, was weird, and B, he's like, sat me down. He's like, hey, so I got some time before, I forget what he had to do, but he's like, you know, I've always wanted to do a documentary. And I'm, you know, sitting there eating, oh, cool. And he's like, and, you know, a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, I don't really think people, like, know that message. Like, would you want to do one? And me being me, I was like, yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, sounds good. You know, no idea. I was getting into this 5-year, very personal process. And you know, so we made that over 5 years. And again, it is what it is because of his, just intuition on the human experience and, he's able to take any and all authenticity that's maybe that authenticity is specific for prison or specific for the military or whatever, but he has a way of translating that specific authenticity into a universal human authenticity and
totally.
Experience.
And that's, I mean, that documentary, can you just tell us a little bit about the documentary?
Yeah. So it's called That Which I Love Destroys Me, which is really a bastardized Latin quote that kind of reversed because it made more sense to me, but it portrays to a degree a solution or, you know, like us overcoming these obstacles. And what's interesting for me is what I realized in hindsight was the documentary was really the beginning of my actual real journey. That was the entire documentary was really just me figuring out the problem. And it was at the end of the documentary when that was over with that I really started working on the solution. Whereas if you watch the documentary, you'd think that it's, you know, totally encapsulated. So the most progress you will have as a person and probably in your life is A, doing the things you don't want to do, and B, addressing the parts of your personality that you bury and hide. We lie to no one more than we lie to ourselves.
You said something earlier about how, like, we are sort of in evolutionary biology, I think you're saying, how, like, we're literally, like, designed to only address and worry about and take care of what's going on right in front of us right now. But right now we're inundated with so much more, like, extraneous fucking information. How do you whittle that down?
You know, for me, again, I mean, I guess, for lack of a better term, the theory or the science is evolutionary psychology, and it basically says that, you know, within evolution, that we are, obviously evolution takes time, so we're not designed for right now. We haven't evolved to right now. We were evolved to thousands of years ago as hunter-gatherer societies, and when you start studying how hunter-gatherer societies worked, and then you apply a lot of problems of today and then apply it to that, you go, I mean, there's not a smoking gun, but it's pretty obvious that the truth is pretty apparent. And on that note, with, you know, if you look at a hunter-gatherer society, it was generally, and some scientist is going to be like, he's full of shit, but, you know, it's like 50 to 100 people was, you know, like a hunter-gatherer tribe or whatever. And, you know, without obviously the internet, radio communication, if somebody from that tribe told you something, it was important to probably your daily survival in that moment. Hey, there's a buffalo coming in to freaking, you know, and ravaging the camp, whatever. I'm making stuff up, but you know what I mean? Like that was relevant. Anything you heard, anything was relevant because it was relevant to that group. That group is your survival. And the only thing that you could possibly hear, by definition of the lack of technology at the time, was something relevant to that 50 to 100 people. Nowadays, we're constantly inundated with information from, you know, not, I mean, everyone's like, 24-hour news cycles. It's like, no. Forget 24-hour news cycles. Try, you know, how many texts a day do you get?
Right.
You know, how many emails a day do you get? We are overloaded with information.
All of those information streams, for the most part, are designed to make it as easy as humanly possible to absorb them.
Yes.
And humans, by nature, take the easy path, right? So to actually turn those things off and point yourself in a different direction takes an amazing amount of mental strength now and stamina.
Totally.
And we don't ever talk about that.
Yeah. Like,
we're asking a lot of people to now look in the face of that information stream and choose a different behavior. It's unbelievably hard to do.
It is because of that wiring of your brain going, but what if one piece is important?
Right.
What if I do need to know one piece, you know? And I'd say most people have done it now where you know, and I'm going to go away for the weekend and I'm not going to have my phone on. And the proof's in the pudding.
I'll turn it off for 5 minutes.
but you know what I'm saying? Like, how do you feel if you had if you were out in the middle of nowhere and you had no reception for a whole day, other than the anxiety of, I got to get a hold of this person. Like, how do you feel?
It's fucking great.
It's great. It's relaxing.
Yeah.
It's because that's what you're designed for.
Yeah.
You're designed for, and I think it's actually Tim Ferriss's term, the low information diet. Now that I'm remembering, but, I've done it now for, 6 months. Like, granted, there's been news things where, you know, like, it's been like 4 days.
Oh, you know, Trump lost, right?
Like,
you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's certain things where people are like, you don't know about this? And I'm like, no. And they're like, oh, my God. And, yeah, you feel like, oh, maybe I'm behind, but.
Are you?
Do I really need to know that?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
You know, I don't. And not to say. And I'm going to put something out there it's going to be controversial, but it's we just need to care less. I think that's the problem. Everyone's pushing caring more, 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 more.
You mean
more.
Like politically and like in the tribalism, like
I mean, if this, it's a collective push to care more about everything and everyone, and the reality is the opposite. The reason that's going to make you miserable, by definition, this is a fact, is I can care about you. I can care about you to level 100, but I can't control or change you.
Right.
So all the things that you care about that you can't control, they're just going to make you miserable.
Yeah.
Because you care about them, but you can't control them. The only thing that you can control is you. If we all cared about ourselves and truly cared about ourselves and controlled ourselves, we'd be happier because we can actually actuate change. And then we wouldn't need to care and push others to do other things because everyone would be, and again, I'm, you know, this is obviously a utopian idea that's not possible, but I'm saying theoretically, the easiest way to be miserable is to try and control everything around
fucking
you.
A.
It'll fundamentally fail.
Fucking A.
Always does. And that's another thing I had to accept is every aspect of myself, even when I switched and was like, okay, I can only control me. Okay, I'll control me. And I started working on control me. And then I also learned, hey, there's some things you can't control about yourself.
It seems like so much of your life, like you just are like this self-motivated, self-driving, like I don't quit, like fucking bring on the pain, whatever. Like, when did you know you want to be in the military? Like, how did that come about?
Well, it's funny you say that because I don't feel like I ever had a decision. It was something that I wanted to do for as long as I could remember. I mean, I could show you pictures of me when I was, you know, 5 in full camo. Like, I mean, that was always who I was. It was something I had to do from as early as I can remember.
Is it in the family?
No. I mean, other than grandfather in World War II, like everyone's.
Sure.
But no, my dad wasn't in the military. It was something I just had this innate, like, I have to do this. I had a Ranger and a Special Forces poster on my wall as a kid. And you know, like, I mean, I probably played guns, you know, played war shit every day, literally every day. And it was just so a part of who I was when I got to that point, you know, it wasn't really a choice. It was just something I felt I had to do.
When you got old enough to remember it, when it became conscious, so like post-childhood, mm-hmm. before signing up, do you remember thinking about the structure of military, the camaraderie and team of military, the patriotism? Like, what was it at that point? Do you have some conscious memory then of what the driver was that excited you to join?
Yeah. And again, you know, I'll be honest, even though it'll raise some eyebrows. I want to kill bad guys.
Straight up.
You know, and again, now the term bad guy, you know, is
yeah.
Don't even get me started on that. But, you know, I looked at it as a kid. You know, I was fascinated with the Middle Ages and knights and samurai, you know. The code of honor and helping those who couldn't help themselves. And that's, to me, special operations was the current equivalent of that.
What was your sort of experiences, if any, with violence, with real violence, before joining the military?
I was pretty good as a kid. I could talk my way out of just about anything. I mean, I got in fights, but generally I could talk my way out of a fight. There was sometimes I didn't want to talk my way out of it, but you know, that was also 80s, you know, time where, you know, kids could punch each other in the face and it wasn't a big deal.
Wouldn't be deal. Yeah.
I never saw I'll say the word true violence, I would say, as a child. I never saw, like, true violence. It wasn't until I was in that I saw, like, what I would call real violence. But, you know, I But I'll say this, and again, sounds weird, but I wanted to see it. Like, I just had this, I wanted to see every facet of the human animal. Like, I wanted to see, mm-hmm. I wanted to see the extremes, you know? I want to see how far this can go. I want to see the animal unleashed.
Yep.
You know?
You knew it was always Rangers.
Well, originally I was a huge, and I'll just say this now because it'll probably come up later, but there's two things I wanted to do as a kid. One, obviously a military, as I've been saying. The other was, I was fascinated by film. I probably watched Star Wars 200 times as a kid. I broke the VHS tape, like, wow. No shit. So I watched Rambo probably over 100 times. Yeah. So I wanted to be a Green Beret.
Yeah.
When I joined, you couldn't get a Green Beret contract. That didn't start until actually after 9/11. So I was like, well, what's the, you know, what can you guarantee me an opportunity for? And they said Ranger. So that's how I went to. And obviously I knew about Rangers, and I had studied all the special operations forces. People are like, why didn't you become a SEAL? And I'm like, mainly because I can't swim. Kind of remove that one from the. And people are like, no, everyone can swim. No, but I seriously don't float.
And can you just explain to people that? Can you just explain, you know, Rangers versus Delta, and like how you did, but like what that is and what that process was like?
Yeah, Rangers are, you know, it's a special operations unit, but it's, for lack of a better term, a starter, you know, you can come in off the street, you know, so you got people that are very senior that have been there 10 years, you know, and you've done all kinds of things. And then you got, you know, 18, 19 year olds straight off the street that then have to get indoctrinated into that program. And really, when I went through the selection process, was called RIP, literally was Ranger Indoctrination Program. Which was, they just smoked the shit out of you and just crushed you every day. And the people that quit didn't make it, and the people that didn't quit made it. You know, I'm oversimplifying.
What's
it,
the percentage there?
You know, I don't know, yeah. Really. It's, I mean, you know, probably 60s, 70s, right. Whatever. But
mostly physical or mental?
Well, both. Most people can handle. The body is always stronger than the mind. Always, 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 always. So it's really a process of essentially making something physical also mental. You know, once your mind is at that level of zero fucks, like it's hard to destroy a person who really just is at that point where, you know, they're zen, and, you know, they're just, I don't care what you do to me. Because it'll end, you know. And anyways, and so you go through that process and you get there, and then you go through, you know, a train-up process. And what I loved about Ranger Battalion is that it is it's a special operations unit, but it's also an elite infantry unit. So for me, you learn infantry tactics. And I'll take a Pepsi challenge to anyone that disputes this, but despite what anyone says, all special operations, all combat, CQB, like the coolest CQB ever, is just infantry combat in a confined space. The fundamental concepts of combat haven't changed forever. You know, as long as it's humans doing it, whether you're holding an axe, a spear, a sword, or a gun, or a bow and arrow, it's a game of angles and, you know, terrain, all these different things. So I love that I learned the basis, the beginnings of basic infantry skills and elite infantry skills. And then later, when I went to the Tier 1 counterterrorism unit, I had a great understanding of those basics. And then, you know, obviously they take it to another level. But anything advanced is just a master of the basics. And I would argue, you know where to cheat the basics and, like, where to just, step 1, 2, 3, I'll just go from 1 to 3.
And that timeline, like when you did that and you made that switch, had you already been in combat?
Yeah, I'd been to Afghanistan. So my first year as a Ranger, my first job was an assistant machine gunner, which is like the worst job ever. You don't even have a gun. Like, I had a pistol and a fucking bag full of ammo and barrels. It was horrible. And a tripod. Yeah. Weighed like 70-something pounds. It was the worst job ever. But, actually, I say it was the worst job ever, but it actually really taught me something, which is taught me to just suck it up and carry weight. And just carrying weight over long distances up hills, again, that's a perfect example of, people would always say, you know, rucking heavy weight is physical. And I'm like, no, it's mental. Because your body wants to quit every second, because you got 100 pounds on your back. It feels like it's trying to crush you like a foot in an aluminum can. But your body can go for 100 miles. The mind wants to quit within the first 10 steps.
Right.
So it taught me that. And then I became a sniper and I did that until I left.
How did 9/11 sort of like play into all of that for you at that time?
That's a great question. Cause I was, and this kind of goes to what you and I were talking about earlier off camera of, you know, I forget how long I had been in by the time 9/11 happened, but, I was right in my like reenlistment window. And before 9/11, I was like, I'm getting out. Like, you know, I joined to go to war. Like I mean, not that there was a war going on when I joined, but you know, I was optimistic. And I just was going to get out, and I don't even remember what my plan was, but I was going to get out. Oh, actually was going to come to Hollywood. So then 9/11 happened, and there was a lot unknown at that time. Third Ranger Battalion went before we did. So, you know, we didn't know. We thought the war was going to be over. So I said, look, if we get orders to deploy to Afghanistan, I will literally re-enlist that day. Until then, I'm not re-enlisting because I'm not going to re-enlist and then the war is over. And, you know, obviously little did we know at that time how long it was going to last.
Right.
But, you know, when you had, you know, I mean, the control over most of the country happened relatively quickly. So, you know, we thought it'd be over with. So, we got orders to Afghanistan, and I reenlisted for 6 years with the intent of going to the other unit or trying to go to the other unit. My first deployment to Afghanistan was after Operation Anaconda. It was actually also, we switched out the people that were at Roberts Ridge, which is a horrible, kind of like a Black Hawk Down scenario, except it was a Chinook, but... it was when they had pushed Anaconda pushed all of the Taliban to the Pakistani border area. So my first deployment was basically building the outstations along the Pakistani border, which is now, you know, Korgal Valley, all those places that, you know, now we know the names of. That was when we first started building those outstations.
Wow.
So it was very interesting because war was new. It was like Vietnam. It was crazy.
What was your day to day like there? I mean, can you take us through it a little bit?
One day I just happened to remember so I was literally sleeping in a goat pen. But one day we had to dig mortar pits. So, and again, you know, like now I look back and I'm like, oh, we should have known, but we had to dig mortar pits. And so we had like, I don't know, six blocks of C4, you know, we're in combat, like, you know, go grab the C4, cool, you know, no one, it's not like anyone's tracking it on a piece of paper, right?
Right.
So we go grab six blocks of C4, we put sandbags on it, we tamp it, and because we have to blow this mortar pit, and the mortar pit's, I forget how deep, but it's got to be like 4 feet deep, I forget, and pretty big. We blow this up, and we walk over there, and I'm not joking, it looked like a little kid had taken a scooper and scooped like three scoops out of the ground. And I'm like, you got to be shitting me. Like, that's how the terrain is fierce there.
Wow.
But I'll never forget just looking at it and going, that was C4, right? He's like, yeah. And we eventually figured it out. But it was just at that time, combat was so new that everyone was just figuring out what it was. For lack of a better term. I mean, we were at that time, you know, as a sniper, I was a sniper team leader. We would go on four-man, we'd go out for 4 days and stay out in the mountains for 4 days, just, you know, or like a, what's it called? A move, Lone Survivor, that type, you know, we'd go and, you know, report on movement and all these different things. And it was just four of us out there. And looking back now, knowing obviously a lot more about combat and war, it's like, man, we were hanging it out there. It was four dudes. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, if you had a force of, you know, whatever, it's not a lot you could do. But at that time, it was just a, now there's no way they would, hell, I was an E, I was like 23 years old or something like that. And I was in charge. Like, there's no way they would let some dudes out of the wire, you know, yeah, go for 4 days. Like, tell us what happens. Just at that time, you know, it was just new.
So fast forward a little bit, you know, you take those feelings you had when the war started and being out there with those four guys and go through the sort of time warp a year, 2 years forward in your time. How did your mindset change and the way you felt about those same things evolve in the time that you were there?
Well, so part of the, I'm going to use the word problem, was like, I didn't really, like, I had a great time in Afghanistan. Like, I had a fucking good time. Like, it was fun. Cause it was what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to combat. Like, I wanted to fucking be buried in mud with a fucking knife, like a, you know, Rambo, man.
Right.
And so I actually really enjoyed it. And then even when, you know, so I get back from Afghanistan and I worked with the unit that I went to. I got to work with them in Afghanistan because they didn't have a sniper team. So we got attached to them. And I was like, okay, like this is the movie cool shit. Like, this is what I want to be doing.
What were they doing?
It was more that, you know, they were developing their own, I'll say it this way, they were able to develop their own intel and develop their own targets. And you know what I mean? Like, they were able to create their own missions.
Yep.
Didn't come from somebody else going, hey, there's guys over. They were going, hey, let's see what's actually there. This is there. Okay, hey, let's go hit it. You know, they were.
So like what we were talking about before, free thinkers, got people who are intuitive, could take initiative.
Exactly. They were developing their own intel. They were seeing everything. They were willing to go out there, firsthand. And see what the intel actually was, not what other people said it was.
Right.
And I just, like, again, all combat has to be driven by off of some kind of intel, or it's just, you know, that's how you get killed. And so I was like, this is really their autonomy was just really, like you said, their ability to free think and not be controlled by the big army system. I was like, that's cool. That's what I want to do. And so when I got back from that trip, I put in a packet and I went through that whole process, which took about a year. And then I got assigned to the unit there. And then I was there for, I don't know how long, maybe 6 months before we deployed to Iraq. You know, and I remember, this is a funny thing, I remember being in training and everyone's like, oh, Iraq, and I'm like, we're not going to Iraq, that ain't gonna happen. Like, Afghanistan, there's no way. Like, I firmly was like, Iraq's not gonna happen. And then when we invaded Iraq, I was like, oh shit, well, wrong about that, you know. And then, you know, 6 months later or whatever, I'm going to flying to Iraq to got to Baghdad and then we were in Fallujah, but and then Fallujah in 2004. I mean, it was fucking World War II. Like, I can't describe it other than it was a war. You know, when you're in Afghanistan, you know, yeah, I've seen Spectre, you know, hammering stuff, and I'd seen things, but like a freaking tank coming in and shooting in a city,
yeah,
a building, yeah. Like, we were calling casts on buildings in the city. I mean,
street to street.
Yeah, that was war to me. You know, I was like, holy shit, like this is on, you know, Cobra gunships coming in and just dumping stuff. I mean, that was like, wow. And it really, again, it was, and it sounds, it is what it is. That's what I wanted. Like, you know, I watched Rambo and I wanted PTSD.
Right.
I don't know what kind of fucked up kid that makes me, but I wanted to be fucked up like Rambo. I wanted to go to the town, grab the M60 and get in a fight with the fucking sheriff. That's what I wanted.
Right. Right.
You know,
when you got wounded, did it change any of that mentality that you had, or did you want to get back to the fight? Did you miss the fight? How did you feel differently after you got wounded?
I didn't change until probably the last 3 years. I can honestly say if there's anything that's surprised me, it's that, you know, 10 years after being out, you're like, well, surely it is what it is at this point. I'm not going to change my mentality. And just in the last 2 to 3 years, I see things absolutely completely different. Absolutely completely different. And it's, and now I see where like a lot of older veterans get, I get it. It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking because it doesn't matter what you say. Like, you can't explain it. But one day they'll get there on their own. And then they too will want to explain it to the younger version of themselves, but they can't. And it's just like watching all these people that you know what's going to happen. You know their future, but you can't.
What flipped that switch for you 2 or 3 years
ago? Man, I don't know. I've thought about that. I've tried to, I don't know. It's awareness of just the overall, and I don't mean this in any, you know, conspiratorial sense, but like the overall system, just the way that human beings have always been over time. It's just the way we are. It's a cycle. And what's interesting about that cycle is, you know, the warrior cycle. It's not new, you know. It's been this way for thousands of years. And one thing that I think, I don't know if I said this in the documentary, but again, I'll still use the word or the term PTSD, even though I think it's more complicated than that. But, you know, back, we'll say Braveheart, great movie. Braveheart times, okay? Braveheart times, you know, we're running at each other and hitting each other with axes, you know, and we're this close together. That's pretty hardcore combat, right? Well, yeah, but also a freaking bomb dropping and blowing up all of us that we didn't even know the fucking airplane was up there.
Right.
And then now we're in pieces. Is that any more or less ruthless? It's about the same.
Yeah.
The difference is now we live a pretty good life, not in war. But back in Braveheart times, even if you weren't in combat, life was fucking hard.
Right. Every time you wanted to eat, you were doing that.
Yeah. I mean, kids died, you know, in childbirth. Very common. Your brother dies from dysentery. Literally shits to death.
Right.
Common. Common. Right. So back then, life was this hard. Combat was this hard. Now, combat's still the same, but life is so much easier. And that difference,
that chasm must be fucking, and that must have been so insane to come back to and see.
It's like you're jumping between two realities,
right?
And that difference to me is PTSD, because you've seen this other reality that you know exists, and then you come back to a place that no one else has seen it. It's like an imaginary world. You're like, no, I'm telling you, like, some people are capable of this. And people are like, oh, no, people aren't capable. But again, they wouldn't know until they've seen it. And another thing that you realize in combat is, I don't care who you are. Everyone has murder in them. Everyone. Absolutely everyone. And people are like, well. The reason we do, and again, there's exceptions to every rule, don't get me wrong. But of course we do. We're designed that way. We're just, it's literally a survival mechanism. If, you know, 200 years ago, it's, you know, me and you hand to hand, like, yeah.
Can you give me an example of something that shocked the shit out of you, or that, like that example of somebody that you wouldn't think they had it in them, or?
You know, I saw people's level of ruthlessness on, you know, some of those people that are just such, you know, the most innocent, nice guy. And then you just see them being absolutely ruthlessly violent. And it's surprising, you know, but what's worse is, again, I'm not that way by nature. And I remember in the beginning, I was like, oh, that's fucking unnecessary. I don't really agree with that. I think you should do the minimum amount to get things done, the minimum amount of violence to get things done. And that's how I felt for the first couple of years. Then I realized, and these people, by the way, that I'm talking about were, at that time, had done more trips, were more experienced than me. And then I realized over time, no, there's, when it comes to, so I have this thing called the violence scale, which is totally arbitrary, I made it up, but, you know, the violence scale is a 1 through 10 scale. And, you know, for me back then, it was like, you know, start with one, and if one doesn't work, you go to two, and if two doesn't work, you go to three, you know, and then once it works, then you stop. And what I eventually learned is that every number in between 0 and 10 is risk. Risk that you're taking on to go through those numbers. For me to truly have no risk, I come in at a 0, as soon as I know it's going to be violent and that switch is flipped, I go to 10. Because if the reason is, if they go to a higher number before I do, I'm dead. They win, I lose. So you learn over time, you have to be absolutely, when it comes to violence and it comes to that game, everything in between, you know, 1 and 9 is just you opening yourself up to lose. And it goes like fighting, and I'm not talking about boxing or like real fighting. I always say, and look, I'm not a martial artist, but I always say the first rule of fighting, same thing as the first rule of gunfighting, same thing as the first rule of war, cheat. There's no honor in death. You know, the freaking first, there's no rules. No one, it's war. Fuck you. Like, that's the reality of it. And it's a horrible reality. And the problem is that we're at a point where we can't do war that way for many reasons. So there's this ambiguity in this. It's just, we're doing war with rules, which doesn't make any sense. It would blow people's minds how much risk we take as soldiers or, you know, airmen, you know, Navy, whatever, Marines to, you know, when we know we shouldn't because of politics, essentially.
Puts a lot of pressure on very young people, though, to be able to accurately gauge when a 1 is even going to become a 2, right? And talk about that challenge a little bit, because I imagine as you got more experienced, that was probably an easier call to make. But for an 18-year-old out there for the first time, if you're looking at it as a 1 or a 10, you actually got to be really good at figuring out when it's a 2. And my guess is when you're not that experienced, that's a pretty damn hard call to make.
It is, and people can't grasp, A, how much training it takes to go into a room and there's a good guy and a bad guy and only shoot the bad guy. I mean, it's not only an unbelievable amount of training, it's an unbelievable amount of time. And on top of all that, you learn through the training process, it's also something in your head. Some people can do it, some people can't.
And you don't really know till you're there, right?
No,
I mean, you can train your ass. And talk about that. I mean, so you know, you went through some of the most extensive training possible. How different, how prepared were you? How different is it when you actually get into the real thing?
You know, it's like you're saying, which is, you know, you don't really... The selection process that we had, and I'll not go into it, but I'll say this, because it's unofficial, this is what I think it is, because what it is, what you're doing, you're like, what the fuck does this have to do with fighting wars? You know, like, this doesn't make any sense, you know? And now I look back and I go, God, it's so smart.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And again, not official. This is what I think it is. What I think it is it's designed to find people that can get instructions once and figure it out. If they make a mistake, they self-correct. They don't go down the rabbit hole of, they just self-correct, because it's all by yourself. You're alone almost the whole time. And the other thing is they learn very quickly, and they learn very quickly from their mistakes. That's what I think it's designed for, because once you have that, you can teach them anything.
I want to ask you something else about, I mean, I guess so much shit I want to ask you, man, but I want to ask you something else about that chasm.
Yeah.
When you think about these things, like what you're talking about the parallel between Braveheart times and war and life, and like how now it's like everything in our life, literally everything is
so
like,
easy.
One thing they talk about is just transportation, just like literally in World War II would have taken few weeks of just still being around soldiers, but like, you know, now it's like literally the next day you're home.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering in your situation as well, because your time there just kind of came to an end, correct? Because you were wounded.
Yeah. And straight, you know, litter to Germany within a day, and then back home took like a week. But
you know, I know Kevin Vance, another guy that we both love and have ultimate respect for. You know, he talked about, you know, why one of the reasons he ultimately, you know, got out was he was like, look, man, I would come home and I'd have to turn the monster off.
Yeah,
and then I'd go and I'd have to turn the monster back on. And it was just getting harder and harder to make that. But for you and your psychology, you still had years, you still were there with these guys doing this thing for years. So I imagine your monster, whatever it was for you, was that's where you were at. So do you feel like that, as far as how, whatever you want to call it, the PTSD, like the psychological distress and torture that you went through, was that part of it? Do you think that it was like the proximity was taken, like the rug was pulled out from under you in a way? Or do you think you were going to go through that no matter what?
I think I was lucky in the sense that I had always compartmentalized my life, just for reasons of how I grew up, you know. So I had always compartmentalized things. So it didn't really affect me as much as I saw it affect others.
In ways did that serve you?
I also think, again, being very forthcoming, I also think I just have a little sociopathic, you know, I've watched like every murder documentary there is, and I'm fascinated by watching psychopaths, and, you know, just psychopathy is just fascinating to me. And I obviously very much have a conscience, and funny story, I was talking to my therapist years ago, and I was like, I'm worried I might be a sociopath, like, because I have these sociopath tendencies. And she goes, Tyler, if you're worried that you're a sociopath,
you're not.
You're definitely not a sociopath. And I was like, oh, can't argue with that one. You know? I'm like, how did I miss that one? But I definitely have this little thing where, and I'll give you a story, and there's nothing... I'm going to tell you the story, and it's going to sound crazy, but it's not crazy, and that's why I'm telling it. We did this raid on this house, and anyways, fucking, I don't know, 13 guys were shot. I can't remember. And I had a digital camera, and I had to go take pictures of the of all of them, all the guys, and run it through the intel system, blah, blah, blah. And I went to this one guy, he was in the kitchen, and he was shot, I don't know how many times, but at least 8. Not that I'm fucking counting holes, but he wasn't dead. And his head was, you know, down, and I got down there to take the picture, and when I got down there, I realized he wasn't dead, and I just kind of watched him, and then I was like, oh, shit, you know, I think he's going to die. I think he's going to die right now. And I just sat there, and I just watched him, and... I literally did it. It was an experiment. like a human experiment. It had nothing to do with the military. Sure. I was just like, I want to see what I, like, does it do anything? And no, I didn't, just nothing. It didn't mean anything to me. And what I realized is that in my head, again, the little sociopathic quality is, mm-hmm. once I put you in a you're a piece of shit category, I don't care if your whole house and family burned down. That's just the way I am. Up until that, I'll be the greatest dude ever. Right. Like, you, I'll fucking die for you.
Right.
But once you are a piece of shit that affects, you know, does damage to other people, you're fucking done.
But isn't that that must be a necessity of fighting in a war, right? 100%. I mean, if you walk into every situation second guessing every single interaction you have while you're out in the field as a soldier, you know, talk about your risk spectrum. You're pushing yourself way down the risk spectrum every single time, right?
Yeah, but you do see there's varying degrees of it. Like, some people can still do the job, but they still can have the awareness of kind of that human interaction, like, oh, you know, this is another human being. Whereas when I, like this guy, it wasn't that he wasn't a human being. I just didn't give a shit. Like, I knew he was a piece of shit. I knew what he was doing. He was a horrible person. And I'm like, I'm glad you're dying. Fuck you. Mm-hmm. And it just didn't, but I didn't have, not only did I not have a sense of, oh, that's sad, but I also didn't have a sense of, all right, mm-hmm. one for the team. There was nothing. Mm-hmm. I had absolutely no feeling towards it. And that was it was weird for me. And I just kind of realized, that's why later, you know, these whole, when I watch sociopaths, I'm like, okay, I definitely have that little quality to where I can just shut off any empathy whatsoever if I deem them as a...
But you have medical confirmation that you're not one, so you're good.
Yeah. Well, technically, it's just an opinion.
Yeah, there you go.
They could get an expert to counter it, but...
Hey, has this country gotten any better at helping veterans with PTSD, or is it status quo?
That's a tough one. It's definitely gotten better. It's gotten better in the sense that the systems have gotten better. The problem that I see is again, so there's a guy who I'll mention, which you should talk to. He's fucking cool as shit. This guy, Marcus Capone, started this, what's it called? Okay, he's gonna kill me, but he's as big as Kevin. You know, they're like the same size, but he started this thing where he basically, it's all alternative medicine. And he takes guys through this whole, you know, ayahuasca, ibogaine, DMT. It's all legit, you know, all this stuff. And I mean, it has changed so many people's lives. And where I'm going with this is, the system will always be the system. You know, for people to think that the VA is going to solve veteran trauma and veteran PTSD is like saying that the DMV does a good job of freaking, you know, monitoring drivers,
right.
You know?
Right.
No, it's right. It's going to come up to, or it's going to come down to us. Who has to figure it out? We do. Is it our responsibility? Well, yeah. Yeah, it is. You can't say, at the same time, you can't say, you know, I believe in less government, but then also go, hey, the VA should fix me.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and again, I'm not talking politics, but I'm not saying it should be up to us. What I'm saying is it is, because we're the ones who have experienced it. We're the ones who know intrinsically what it is by our own feeling and experience. And it's just like I told one of the VA psychologists this. I was like, you're telling me everything that you've read it to be, and I'm telling you what it is. But because you have the degree, you're right and I'm wrong.
Right.
That makes no sense. Right. Like listen to me. Like I want help. I'm trying to help you help me, but you're fighting me on it. And so I think it's up to us. And I think the system has gotten better, but ultimately, the ultimate way, like this, this thing that Marcus Capone is doing is it's fringe. It's out there. 10 years, it won't be out there. It'll be normal.
But those options at least exist now.
They exist now, and they exist because some veteran tried them, or you know, and Marcus has really been spearheading it. But you know, there's this brainwave treatment. There's all kinds of these things. And here's the worst part: all of them right now are the brainwave thing, Marcus's thing. Marcus is a former Dev Group guy. It's the amount of time it will take for those things to trickle down to a system like the VA. Yeah. It's just, it's the government. It's a bureaucracy. It's a behemoth. And that's why I say, I think it's up to us to take care of our own, because it's just the system will never, by definition of what it is. I mean, I was a very lonely kid. I had fucking imaginary friends, you know. I was a very lonely kid, and opening up my feelings got me hurt, so I just shut them off as a kid. And that was my childhood, and that was safe for me. So that made the military really easy,
because
I already shut off my feelings, you know. And I think a lot of guys, you know, maybe if they didn't shut them off when they were a kid, you know, once they start deploying, they shut them off, and then that, again, PTSD is when they've been out long enough and the feelings get turned back on, and now there's a backlog of emotion that just comes flooding in, and it doesn't I mean, emotion by definition doesn't make sense. It's not logical. So it's like, how do you logically process something that's not logical? You don't. You just feel it.
I guess one of the things too that I just like also like knowing about you, and then since the documentary, because like you said, like it's just so much has changed since then, obviously, you know, and so much your life has changed. It seems like your personality is like so geared towards you driving yourself, but you also from like your work in the military, and now like what you're doing, you're such a team oriented person. Like you're so good at like inspiring people, helping people, building people up, understanding what people need to hear, what they don't need to hear. You know, the only way to like deal with like deep psychological blocks or problems or PTSD, whatever the fuck you want to call it, is like, you can't do that alone. Like you have to go to other people. So it's like those two things were kind of like playing against each other. Would you say that's right?
100%. I only did the documentary because Rick was, you know, asked me, and I said, yeah. And then
I imagine you were hesitant.
No, I really wasn't. I wasn't, because it was just me talking on camera about myself, which I'm doing right now. I don't give a shit. I'll tell you about the fucking me as a kid at camp. I shit my fucking pants. I don't care.
I did too, like, bro.
Yeah, it happened. Horrible day. But I don't care. I don't judge myself on anything I've done or been. And
it's the camp diet, man. That's what you just judge the camp diet.
Yeah. It was a bad one too. But the, you know, so I didn't have a problem talking on camera. It was when it became something, and I first had to, I've only ever watched it once, and Rick fucking forced me to. I drank an entire bottle of wine, and I don't really drink a lot of alcohol, and watched it. And then when I had to like go and talk about it with audiences and get asked questions, that's when I got uncomfortable, because I don't take compliments well. You said some very nice things. I disagree with most of them. And I'm joking, but I don't take compliments well, because that instinct to push myself, I only want to hear what I'm doing wrong.
It's the only way to help.
You know what I mean? Tell me what I'm doing 100%. Wrong. Tell me what I'm
does
doing
nothing
wrong.
For you. Yeah.
And so it was very hard to hear people connecting with me, because again, I shut off my feelings. So a person connecting through my life was like really uncomfortable for me. And so it was a very strange realization of, oh, I did this because it's talking in front of a camera, don't really care. And the other lesson I learned from the documentary was I need to put myself out there more. And I struggle with that every day. And every day. I mean, on Instagram, I just actually started posting more in the last, I mean, I'll go months and not post something. And the last like week I've post like kind of a message, a life lesson or something. And every freaking time I do, at least one person, if not more, will go, thanks for posting this. I needed this.
Dude, or and, that what you posted about your dad, I was going to talk about. I was like, yo, dude, that fucking really, like, I was going to thank you for it. But I know that's also like, yeah, you don't really want to hear that. You know what I mean?
I'm trying to get better at it.
Well, you know, like what I was going to say about that too, man, is, you know, what's so inspirational for me, and I mean, you've always been inspirational for me, period. But like, I just think that like this, like acting shit, like art, you know, like that saved my life. You know, like I wasn't like in theater troops, you know, like I was like, it was not me, bro.
Yeah.
And there's a risk and a danger to putting yourself out there and to like being honest, like whether it's in front of a camera, whether it's in front of a stage, or whether it's just in front of people. And it's like now, man, it's like you're a professional artist. Like that's like you're fucking the real deal, dude. Like you're fucking acting, you're directing. It's like you know, and you know, real life and our trauma and the shit that we've like that is ultimately, it's like, you know, it's like that's our currency, bro. Like that's like turning that into positivity. Touching other people, putting ourselves out, like that shit is like what it's about. Because like ultimately I just know this, but like we're not trying to do this to like, you know, have a fancy car or anything, you know. It's like we're trying to connect with people. We're trying to like put a label to some sort of emotion or feeling that someone else may have felt and say like, hey man, I feel this too. That's connectivity. It's like why motherfuckers have been telling stories since they were cavemen, you know what I mean? And that's what we're after. And like I'm wondering, like now being an artist or being in the like doing this, how has that made you grow and how has it changed you? Like what effect has it had?
So I really had to figure out, you know, what it was that attracted me to film as a kid. I mean, I remember being like 7 and walking around the track with my best friend at the time, and we would like Siskel and Ebert movies, you know, I mean, we would break them down, not just like, oh, that was cool, you know, like, oh no, that scene was really good because,
yep,
you know, and again, but what was it about film? And I've really thought about it in the last several years, and I realized I shut off my feelings as a kid. The only time I had allowed myself to feel is when I was watching a movie.
Wow.
By myself.
Wow.
You know, like, okay, fine, fuck it. I cried during Notebook, all right? Yeah. I was by myself, I watched it, bro. Fuck you, I held everything fuck in, yeah, and it nuked me, no. But but it was a safe place for me because it wasn't about my emotions.
Sure.
Like it was watching something on screen. So it, that's okay to be, you can let out those emotions because they're not yours.
Right.
And so now for me, everything I think of is, I still have problems connecting in person. But if I can put some art, whether it's, you know, on camera or behind the camera or writing, if it connects and helps someone understand themselves, then I'm not connecting in person, but I'm connecting through that art. And I don't think there's anything at this point in my life, I don't think there's anything more important in the world than art.
Mm.
I really don't. I don't think I agree with you. I don't think I would be alive if it wasn't for art. It's all I really aspire to do. You know, the flip side, which obviously you'll know, is, you know, we work in a business that's a business, mm-hmm. and you have to make somebody money to make art,
mm-hmm.
which is obviously difficult. But I love the philosophical nature of you know, who this character is, and just all this stuff. Like, you really ultimately film, actually, fuck it, all art is ultimately just about humans connecting in the human experience. All it is, yep. You know, whether it's sculpture, whatever, it's about being human and really about being emotional and about our emotions. And I mean, there is a logical component to storytelling, no question, but I just absolutely feel like, quite frankly, I feel like it's important. And as a veteran, I want to tell veteran stories that I feel what I know about what I've been through you know, I tell people this all the time. I'm like, despite what anyone tells you, and I actually, when I was at the agency, I actually said this inside there. I'm like, I don't care what you guys say. Hollywood is the largest PSYOPs campaign in the world. And they didn't like that. And they didn't think it was as funny as I did. Yeah, yeah. I was like, that's hilarious. You know, and they're like, but I really, it is. And the ability for me to get out a message that I think can help people. I mean,
yeah.
that's at least the hope with this industry is putting out things that really help people or connect them or make them think about things they haven't thought of about themselves, et cetera. And then I guess there's entertaining too.
I'm so curious though, because you talked a little bit about, you know, talking to your shrink and just the disconnect between what your shrink had read in the book and your own lived experience and how that chasm could kind of never be bridged. So talk about that in terms of working in Hollywood, right? Where like you have this lived experience out in the real world where there may be one other person on the set, if anybody, who has that shared experience that you had, yet all these people are trying to recreate a reality that frankly only you know. Does that make you this just like, do you have to just say eventually, like, I gotta let it go because they can't get it exactly right? Or how do you process through that when you're working?
That's a great question. And I'll say it this way. The difference, so, you know, I've brought in several people into the industry, military people that I was like, hey, you know, they were interested, or I was just trying, hey, you know, whatever. And I've had them be advisors and then that happens to where they can't adjust to the process of how film is made. It has to be this way. Doesn't have to be anyway. For me, anything I was advising was never about advising the military. It was creating the art. I love, you know, working with good actors, because no one will listen to you more intently than a really good actor. Just like, and they like, it's like a vacuum, just taking it all in. It's pretty impressive. But also it's just the awareness of conversation. You know, it's like you tell them something and they go from here to here, not experiencing it themselves. And they go, well, I imagine if this, then blah. And you're like, how the fuck did you put that?
Talk about that psychopath shit.
Like, how did you put that together? How did you make that jump? You didn't experience it yourself. I didn't tell you the in between, and they get it. And it's really the quality that the, you know, A-list actors like yourself have is this innate ability to just curiosity, but just this innate understanding of humans and emotions. And it's just, it's really, and it's not taught. It's something intrinsic inside you. Like you have it or you don't. And obviously it's like an Olympian, right? Michael Phelps, you know, is Michael Phelps because his body is Michael Phelps. And then he trained his ass off. You know, it's like, there ain't no way I don't float. There's no way if I train like Michael Phelps, I would be an Olympian. And you got to have both components.
So he grew up with me, bro. So like everybody who I grew up with thinks acting's a fucking, you ain't got to get no compliments on that. He's like, go fuck yourself.
I was going to say, you know, we have a 35-year track record of never complimenting each other.
Yeah,
about to utter a compliment.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Fuck,
I don't
bro.
Know if I can squeeze it, but I'm going to try here. And I was going to say, like, what you said about actors really listening is also, I think, why you've gotten so much joy out of this podcast.
Definitely.
Is because having these conversations, like, you are so equipped to live in the moment of a conversation like this and extract everything of value out of it. And I think that's why this has been so enjoyable for you and why you put so much time into it.
Lick my balls,
I'm done.
Bro.
I'm never fucking saying that again.
Lick the undercarriage.
That was horrible
of my nuts,
for me.
Bro.
I wish that hadn't happened.
I'm just proud that I was a catalyst for that moment. I'm very happy.
I gotta shake that off.
I'm just wondering, just from your perspective, totally different. One of the things we've done is, like, you know, like I lived in Russia for a couple of years. It's like where I studied and shit. I still have a bunch of friends over there and friends in the Ukraine and stuff. I'm just wondering from your perspective, like, what's your do you have a take on that, or like how do you feel about it, like the for what's going on over there?
Yeah. So the best way to say it would be, you know, my take on it, going back to our earlier conversation, my take on it 3-4 years ago would have been, well, 10 years ago, you know, would have been very different than it is now. Now I it just makes me sad, and it makes me sad because, you know, it's very easy not having been in any of those shoes. It's very easy for someone to go, yeah, fuck the Russians, fucking Ukrainians, kill them all. And don't get me wrong, I understand that mentality, and there's truth to it. The flip side is, you know, I guarantee most of those Russians on the ground don't want to be there, mm-hmm. and are, you know, essentially conscripted and forced to be in that position, and they're getting slaughtered. You know, the Ukrainians are like, dude, you're invading my country. Fuck you, get out. You know, it's like when I was in Iraq. And I would tell the bad guys through interpreters, I'd be like, look, dude, you want to fucking shoot me? You want to blow me up? Cool. I get it. I'm in your country. If you were in my country, I'd kill the fuck out of you.
Yeah.
Like, we're square. Like, sure. I'm cool on that. Like, I have no issue with you trying to kill me. You blowing up your women and children to kill some of my guys, I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And I don't agree with that. But going back to Ukraine, it's... Again, it's the system, it's politics, and again, it you just see it. It's so obvious, and it's just sad that, you know, it's 2022, and we're like, it's so different than it was, you know, 1100. But are we really that different than kings, queens, pawns, serfs? Like, are we really that different, noblemen? Really? No. It's just humans. It's the way we're designed, and. It's sadly we keep denying our fundamental nature, and I think that's what's hurting society right now, is this fundamental denial of that we're actually fucking dark creatures. And the more you deny it, the more evil things you can do, because you're lying to yourself that that you don't have a dark side, but you do. And you know, that can be seen daily. You know, you can be seen when you get cut off in traffic, you know, like, fuck you, I got in my way first. Okay, that's a micro analogy for, let's say there's only so much food,
right?
Like during the pandemic, fuck you, those are my toilet paper.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's we're designed that way, and we don't need to judge it, you know. We just need to accept it, and you know, I'm sad that it got to the point where it actually happened, and they actually invaded, and they haven't pulled out yet. I mean, that's just it worries me not as a country, it worries me as a world, that there hasn't been enough leverage to pull Russia out of the Ukraine. The world's getting weirder. I mean, we're approaching so many times that are unprecedented in the history of mankind. Like, as an example, okay, Ukraine, Russia, did he use conscripts and you know, push him? Yes. So he still had to get people, you know, to go. But we're not far away from a person being able to wage war without another human.
Right. Yeah, that's insane.
I mean, it's never happened before, and we're not far from it. In fact, I'd say it's possible right now, It's I'm sure, laboratory possible. And I don't think people are aware how fast things are going to change. They're already changing fast, but it's an exponential curve. And it's changing faster than people can accept and process. And it's only going to get faster. Going back to therapy, too, it's there's this therapy called radical acceptance, I believe it is, where you're just like, no, no, no. And then at a certain point, you go, oh, my God. And then you just, like, accept everything at one time. You know, I actually had that moment where I was just miserable. And this will segue to, this is about a year ago, and I was just miserable. And I just wasn't happy, and everything was, I was just angry all the time, all these things. And I'm like, fuck, man, what, how did I get here? Again, self-aware, like, how did I get here? And I thought about it, and I could only come up with one logical conclusion. And that was, what if everything I thought was wrong? Like, what if everything that I've denied is actually true? And what I denied for a long time is any form of spirituality. I'm not a religious person, but I just deny that. Again, I shut off my feelings, shut off that, you know. And I'm like, well, what if there's something to that, you know? And I just, and it's just so crazy how you can fundamentally live your life for so long and then one day realize that, you know, you're wrong about so much, you know? And the fact is, it's a fact that right now, everything we're talking about, it won't probably be wrong, but we'll know a lot more about it, sure, in 5 years. 100%. And then we'll look back and go, oh my God, we were so naive then.
Yeah.
The smartest you are in your entire life is the day you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
How fucked up is that?
Yeah.
You know? Kind of a downer, sorry. My bad.
I appreciate you guys letting me sit in on this, man.
Dude, absolutely. It was
a pleasure, again, to meet you.
Yeah, same. And it was great to have you. And it was even that one moment was just the best. Yeah. So I'm glad it happened.
Glad I was here for that, too.
Yeah.
Yo, can I ask you a couple more questions? Is that cool?
Dude, right. Of course, man.
All right, Gary.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Later, bro.
Do you now, or at any point in your life, like, have you felt like you've had, like, a spiritual connection, or...?
You know, when I put effort into it last year when I had time, I'm not a religious person. And, I was at this place and they were talking about spirituality and they're like, you know, it doesn't, you know, it can be whatever, I forget what they called it, your spiritual whatever. And I used the universe, you know, and the reason is I definitely didn't create it. I don't control it. I know it exists. So, okay, the universe will be my, you know, my spirit, animal, for lack of a better term, and it definitely did something, and it was interesting because I couldn't tell you how or why, but I think what it did was it subconsciously took a little bit of my need to control away, mm-hmm. And I didn't realize how much that I had a problem with control. Yeah.
But it's also, it's like a shift from, it's a shift from controlling to behaving. I don't know. I look at the times in my life that, like, trying to connect to something bigger. I've always been really envious of people who have, like, a pretty rich or like, at least cogent spiritual life.
Yeah.
I feel like it, like, helps them, you know, like, in some ways.
I'm the same way.
You've been in some incredibly, I don't want to use the word traumatic, but, like, you've been in fucking super, super fucking high pressure situations. Were you talking to anybody in those moments? Was there anybody, like?
I'm honestly so glad you asked that question, because it's, again, I think an interesting story. So, and I don't know if I've ever told it. So when I got blown up, I had an arterial bleed. So from my ulna artery was bleeding. So, you know, it gives you about, I mean, it depends. And again, some doctors can be like, fuck you, you're wrong. You know, you have a couple minutes.
Did you know that?
Not at first. At first I thought my arm was blown off. Cause I could feel it gone. I know that sounds weird, but it felt not there. Cause it blew my nods off. So I couldn't see, everything was dark in the house. There was a gunfight going on. I couldn't hear anything, you know? But when I eventually got outside of the house, there was a like a fucking porch light on. And that was the first time I looked at it, and it was fucking hamburger meat. And then
it was hamburger meat.
I mean, it was just, it was broken in so many places that it wasn't just like twisted. It was like, it was, I don't know how they saved it, but it was mangled. It literally looked fake. But I noticed that I was bleeding pretty profusely. And then there was a wall, like, you know, and I just looked at it. I'm like, well, that ain't fucking happening. You know, like, I'm not getting over that. And I think I maybe at that point lost consciousness for a minute or two. I remember just plopping against the wall. But anyways, at first I remember thinking, okay, my arm is definitely gone. It's fucking gone. Like, fucking goodbye. Have a good one. I'm going to be an armless vet. And I just remember this like whole process in my head of thinking, God, I'm gonna be one arm, and just like flashes of Vietnam veterans, you know, were in my head. And then I'm like, all right. And I kind of accepted that. And then I remember going, whoa, wait a minute. You might die. And I was like, oh fuck. Yeah. Like and this within, you know, a couple seconds.
Sure.
I was like, holy shit, you might die from this. Like, you got to fix this. And I'm like, yeah, you don't want to die from this. That'd be fucking stupid. And then when one guy got to me, and this is just fucking cosmic stardust, the guy that comes and puts the tourniquet on my arm is the guy who I was with on that mission in Afghanistan when I was a Ranger. What are the odds of that? So I'm there, and I'm laying there, and I'm.
Wait, which guy from?
So remember when I said I worked with the unit I wanted to go to, and they were selecting their own targets and doing stuff in Afghanistan?
Yeah.
When I was a Ranger.
Yeah.
That guy, cut to, I'm in his unit now.
Wow.
And he's the one who put the tourniquet on my arm.
Wow. The guy you're like, I want to do that.
Yeah. What are the odds? You know, years later. And so I. But I'm there, and it just kind of occurs to me that I might die, and people were working on me, but you know, you don't know, it's hard to gauge, you know it's bad, but like again, you don't.
And are the guys that, I mean, you were shot at?
Oh, there's a gunfight going on in the house.
Right.
Still.
So I mean, yeah. Has that been dealt with yet, or?
No, I think it was still going on.
They were still fighting.
Yeah, it was a lot of guys. So anyways, I'm laying there and I'm like, oh fuck, I might die. And then it just kind of hits me. I'm like, shit, I might actually die. Oh my God. Like this is when religion comes. And I'm like, I'm in this, you know, pain. I'm in this fucked up situation. I'm like kind of excited. Like again, human experiment. I'm like, all right. Like, come on, religion, like, you know.
Where are you, God?
Where you at? Where you at? Yeah. And I'm, like, laying there, and I'm, like, yeah. And I'm, like, all right, you know, how do I feel? And I just started, like, kind of going through the process, and I'm, like, nope, still nothing. Like, I legitimately thought I could die, and I just was, like, I don't have it. It just wasn't there. And it's because I wasn't open to it, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not a fool. It was... I was expecting something to like hit me over the head. Sure. And, you know, and again, it's the people that are open to that concept and all those things, it comes to them. The people that, it's just like I don't believe in ghosts, and I go to a freaking ghost house and I sleep there. And, oh, shockingly, I slept through the night and had no fucking problems.
Right.
Weird,
right?
Oh, you know, they must have not come out that night. No,
right.
It's that I don't fucking care, you know? And so it's one of those things where, it kind of disappointed me, to be perfectly honest. It kind of, and again, it was my lack of, you know, but I was hoping that I was going to have some kind of like sense of some kind of next step. And I just didn't. I just felt like I was just going to die right there in the fucking mud and a fucking shithole in Solder City shanty town. Like I didn't have a good feeling about it. I had like, how fucking stupid would it be if I fucking died right here in the mud laying down? It just like kind of disgusted me. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It didn't feel honorable to, you know what I mean? It didn't feel like I thought it should feel. It's like going out on the battlefield, you know, like Lieutenant Dan, you know, like it just felt like.
If you experience anything like that now, do you feel like it would be different? I don't know if that's an answerable question, but
I would hope. I definitely have a different spiritual belief. Now the simple way to explain my spirituality is I don't know what it is, but there's something bigger than me.
Yeah.
I know that.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's a fact that I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
But it's proof that there's got to be because I didn't fucking create myself. So that's kind of where I'm at. So I would hope it would be different. But I've always been jealous of people that are on that spiritual wavelength to where it's just a real connection.
Right now, you have so much to say. Like, right now, you have so much to do. Like, you have so much work. Like, you have so much shit that you want to do and accomplish. And it just seems like, you know, when I don't know, man. It just seems to me so much of like your psychology back then was like fucking turning shit off.
Yeah, it was about shutting everything off. And now it's about trying to open up. And you know, the other thing. I mean, I was just a sad kid, you know. I was a kid where they would, you know, go like, hey, we're going to go toilet paper old Mr. Johnson's house. And, you know, I was like fucking 7, 8, 9, and I'd be like, why? I don't want to do that. He'll have to pick it up. And they're like, what the fuck are you talking? You know, I'm like, that would be sad watching old man John. And it just like, and they're like, fucking moron. You know, it just... discomfort is growth, and I wanted that discomfort.
Is that a bucket that you feel like is filled with, like, have you filled that bucket, or does that go forward?
It's a struggle, you know. It's a struggle.
I hear you, bro.
It's a struggle. That's a daily struggle. And and because again, I can see where, you know, there's a lot to self-care and all these different things, but there hasn't been a time that I haven't done something extremely self-destructive that I didn't learn something from and that I didn't really gain from the experience. And you know, you're kind of, it's like balancing. It's like, is it worth it? You know? And I just have this fundamental need sometimes. And again, going back to what I said way earlier, which is about acceptance of self, like I have finally had to accept that at a certain level, I crave self-destruction. I just do. And I accept it, and I had to accept it because if I pretended it wasn't there, it would happen, you know, without me really being, you know, I would just go into that mode. So right.
I just like, look, man, again, you know, I'm super interested in that, and I think that's also not sound like a fucking douchebag, but it's kind of like the artist journey too. It's like I believe something, you know, we talked about him earlier. It's something Shia and I kind of argue about all the time, like this need to like bleed out. I don't know if that's the same, but can you give me an example of like the last time or something recently you felt like you've done that was self-destructive?
Usually my self-destructive behavior was with women, quite frankly. I mean, I partied in Vegas with strippers for like 2 years straight. It was fucking literally all I did, you know? And that's a crazy lifestyle, and it was a destructive lifestyle. And again, it was, how much can I destroy myself and still bring myself back? What level of destruction can I go to and still come back from?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I haven't found it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know what it is. It's fucking death, obviously. But how close could I get to that? It's a perverted sense of self-challenge.
Challenge, yeah, and that cycle. But is there a way you can channel that into work?
And that's what I've been doing, I've been much better, like the last, I finally realized that about a year ago, that self-destruction and that I was attracted to that destruction, like, that girl's fucking crazy. Well, let me give her a call. Let me take her out. You know, like, hey, those friends, you shouldn't hang out with them. Fucking come on, guys. Yeah, you know, like that was just what I was.
100%.
The way it was. And you know, like a good example would be, not that I know specifics at all, but commonly mentioned about, you know, Heath Ledger and his process for the Joker and all these things. It's it's a similar mentality of self-destruction. And the problem is society or people that don't have that, it doesn't make sense. So yeah. When you're, you know, that way in your normal life and you see self-destructive behavior, people are like, you know, in the military, and the reason I bring it up in the military is because it's being, you know, they're just wrecking dudes for getting DUIs, getting, you know, dude, what the fuck were you doing speeding 120 miles an hour? Well, because they were trying to get some adrenaline.
Yeah.
Once you've been at this level of adrenaline and you go home, like, once you've been shot at in close proximity, well, you know, how are you going to replicate that? Hop, you know, buy a new motorcycle and go 130 miles an hour, you know? Right. It's like, okay, man, maybe I'll get the cops to chase me. Fuck it. I don't care. Because I'm trying to feel, you're chasing the dragon of destruction no different than chasing the dragon on a drug.
Yeah.
Because despite what most people say, adrenaline is an addictive fucking drug.
Absolutely.
And once you've got it, you're always looking for it again.
You know, I did see that post that you put up on your pop and then like tying it into, you know, that little part of the documentary and stuff. It's like, can you just like... Where are you guys at, and like, what is your relationship with your dad, if you don't mind me asking?
So, my dad had is an alcoholic. Has always been an alcoholic. I knew he was an alcoholic when I was, you know, fucking 5-6 years old.
Yeah.
You know, 2 or 3 years ago, I had to bail my dad out of jail on New Year's Eve. For a DUI, he's fucking 72 years old, you know. But I hated him. I hated him because he was a shitty dad. I mean, you know, I just wanted someone to take me hunting and shooting, and you know, he just drank and passed out. And again, you know, it's not like he fucking beat me up. But you know, it's many kids had many worse childhoods. Don't get me wrong. But I didn't really. I hated him, you know. And then when I was forced to, you know, he, because of his drinking, my mom divorced him. He, you know, didn't have a place. He got into a car accident, drinking and driving, lost his vehicle, didn't have a place to live. So I let him move into my house. And you know, it was scary how many things I saw in him that are qualities in me. And I hate those qualities about him. And so then when I realized that I do them, fuck, it was like a slap in the face because I realized like I do those things. You know what I mean? Like, one would just be, you know, like immediately being defensive. If you say something, I know, like immediately trying to say something's not my fault. Like, he always does that. And it's like, and it could just be it's not about whose fault it is. You're just trying to express your feelings about something or whatever. But it made me understand him. And it made me realize that my struggles were also his struggles. Mm-hmm. And that I've got to get over the past, and I shouldn't judge him on anything. And now too, I went through a period where I wanted a dad. I wanted him to stop drinking, and then I just finally realized, like, he'll never stop drinking. Like, how it hasn't killed him, to be perfectly honest, he should be fucking studied by science, because I don't know how he's not dead.
Yeah.
But I finally just had to accept him for who he is. He's an alcoholic. He'll always be an alcoholic. Alcohol will kill him, and I just have to accept that, and that doesn't change the fact that he's my dad, and I'll always love him for that.
Yep.
I accept him as who he is. I accept his dark side, and in that process was, again, me learning to accept my own. You know, my self-destruction comes from him.
Yeah.
And I have absolutely no doubt. My dad would have been happy, and again, this is so fucked up, but it's true. My dad's life would have been complete had he gone to Vietnam and died. That's what he wishes his life was.
Wow.
when he was at my house, he'd watch fucking Vietnam documentaries literally all day long, interviews just nonstop. He had a hernia, which is why he didn't go to Vietnam. And he just, again, it's like he wanted to go and either come back fucked up or come back or not come back. And I'm like listening to this stuff. I'm like, he didn't even go to Vietnam. Why the fuck is he? And then I slowly put it together. It's like, there's just something in him. It's the same thing in me. And we don't choose it. But to deny it's there is to deny who we are.
Fucking A, dude. You know? And knowing it is like every, you know, especially as an artist, man. Like yeah. Knowing that it's everything, like, you know, everything.
And that reckless abandon that you're talking about, though, that's positive destruction.
Dude.
You know?
Dude. Yes, man. Positive. Super positive. And I think I would even go as far as say, like, the darker you can go, the deeper into the wound, like I was saying, that you can go into yourself and, yeah. like, to do that, even if it costs part of you, it's actually... I mean, it's such a fucking lame word, but it's super fucking therapeutic, too.
I knew
it's like, you know what I mean? It's such a bitch word, but it's like, you actually are like, yo. And then you're like, I left that. I did that actually. Like, I pulled out something from me that has only led to, like, destruction, violence, mayhem, betrayal, awfulness, vileness. And I, like, pulled it out of me in, like, a fucking actually safe way where I wasn't actually hurting anybody.
Yeah.
And, like, somebody will see it and be like, yo, man, I know that. Like, I fucking, fuck, I see that. I'm really, really fucking excited to see, you know, like, what this next chapter of your life is going to be, man.
I mean, going to what you just said, it's really what I figured out is just, and I should have mentioned this earlier, but the need for destruction is not going to change. It's about just choosing positive destruction.
Yeah.
And actually I could also replace the word destruction with chaos. I crave chaos.
Me too.
Because I'm comfortable in chaos.
Yeah.
And there's few things more fucking chaotic than a film set. And
being
on camera is fucking chaotic.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
directing, chaotic. Yeah. And I love that chaos. I crave it. I'm comfortable in it. And it's healthy chaos.
The fact that you're going to be able to, like, marry all this and, like, that you're, it's fucking great. Thanks for being here, everybody. I really appreciate it. If you dug what you saw and you want to hear more, subscribe, like, do all that stuff. It'd mean a lot to us. I hope you dig these episodes as much as we dig doing them. You guys take care of yourself.